This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The film director Sidney Lumet died of lymphoma last Saturday. He was 86. We're going to listen back to my interview with him. The New York Times obituary described Lumet as a director who preferred the streets of New York to the back lots of Hollywood, and whose stories of conscience, 12 Angry Men, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, The Verdict, Network, became modern American film classics. Lumet also made the 1964 film The Pawnbroker, starring Rod Steiger as a Holocaust survivor who owns a pawn shop, and Failsafe, about a nuclear showdown between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Lumet directed Michael Jackson and Diana Ross in the 1978 musical The Wiz. He was given an honorary Academy Award in 2005. Let's start with a scene from Lumet's final film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, which was released in 2007. It stars Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke as two brothers whose parents own a jewelry store. Hoffman plays a businessman and addict who's embezzled a large amount of money from his company. Facing an audit, he's in desperate need of cash. He's trying to rope his younger brother into helping him pull off a heist.
What are we doing?
To win.
It's a jewelry store. Does this ring a bell?
No.
What if I tell you it's got a footlocker on one side and a Claire's accessories on the other? Yeah, that's right. You got it. Now listen. We don't want Tiffany's. We want a mom-and-pop operation in a busy place on a Saturday with a week's take still in the safe. We both work there. We know the safe combinations. We know the burglar alarm signals. We know everything is. I figure between the week's take, the jewelry and the cases, the vault, there's a $500,000 haul. I figure probably six. That old dumb old lady that works there, she's alone till noon. She's not going to be a problem.
Andy.
Yeah?
That's Mom and Dad's store.
That's what I said. The mom and pop operation.
I spoke with director Sidney Lumet in 1988.
You've made about 38 movies in a little over 30 years. And it reminds me of the old studio days in a way, when there were a lot of movies being made and when directors and actors used to do a lot of movies per year. How have you managed to keep that pace up, especially considering how the movie industry has changed?
Lucky, Terry. No, I love work and I love movies. I think if I could ever, and these things are clearly impossible, but if I could have had the artistic freedom that I enjoy now under the old studio system, which would have been impossible, by the way, I think I would have been very happy working in a studio, because I love going from one project to another. I love when I work with actors who I find exciting to work with. I love repeating with them and working with them again and again.
So you think of yourself as having more artistic freedom now than you did when you were starting because of how the movie industry has changed?
Not partially.
Or because of your stature.
Part of it is muscle, you know. Yeah. You get a couple of hits behind you and you can slowly start encroaching into that area. But I think you're right. I think the studio system has changed. I don't think that Louis B. Mayer would have given me Final Cut no matter how many hits I'd had. He would have never given up that prerogative.
Now, you insist on that, right? When you take on a movie, you must have Final Cut, which means what exactly?
Well, it means that there can be nothing. The film cannot be touched after you finish editing it, whether in the soundtrack or visually. It's yours.
What kind of problem had you run into with previous movies that taught you needed to demand Final Cut?
Well, as an example, many, many years ago, I did a very, very interesting picture. I think a very good picture. It's one of the few that I like better now than at the time that I did it. A picture called The Hill with Sean Connery. And it was not much of a success in America, but a good picture. And at that time, I did it for Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and at that time, they were being owned by a new person. They were changing hands almost daily. There were three new managements in the period of a year. And at one point, they just said it as a matter of company policy that a picture had to run 1 hour and 55 minutes because they thought that this would work well for their relationships with the exhibitors. And the picture ran 2 hours and 2 minutes, and they just insisted that I take 7 minutes out. They didn't care where it came from. It didn't matter to them that there were no 7 minutes to take out without destroying the movie. And it was a hell of a battle, and the only reason I won it, actually, was because management changed hands again, and a new management came in, which was listened with slightly more sympathetic ears. But if the old management had continued running Metro, they simply would have taken the film and removed 7 minutes, period.
Right.
And that kind of thing goes on constantly. A great many directors have suffered very severely from that.
And that's still going on.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your first film, made in 1957, and this was 12 Angry Men, a courtroom drama. You had before that been directing television, live television dramas. Was this a good transition to make since it was basically a one-set movie? It's a courtroom drama. It's a jury drama. They're in the deliberation room most of the movie. Was that a good place to start?
It was good, and it was a great problem, except that I was dumb enough not to know what the problem was. I found out after I had done the movie and people liked it that it was very difficult to shoot a movie in one room. That never occurred to me.
Really?
I had just plunged in with complete ignorance, knowing what I wanted to do with camera, knowing that I could make the camera a good interpretive part of the movie itself, and just blithely went ahead, shot it in 19 days, happy as a lark, and didn't know what the problem was. I may have felt enormously secure at the confinement of it because my background, as you say, had been live television and the theater. So the idea of staging something in one room was something that came very easily to me.
Well, the movie starred Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb. Fonda is the only juror initially convinced of the defendant's innocent. Cobb is the last holdout. I want to play a clip from this movie, 12 Angry Men.
Did you ever see a woman who had to wear glasses and didn't want to because she thinks they spoil her looks?
Okay, she had marks on her nose. I'm giving you that. From glasses, right? She didn't want to wear them out of the house or people think she's gorgeous. But when she saw this kid killing his father, she was in the house alone. That's all.
Do you wear glasses when you go to bed?
No, I don't. No one wears eyeglasses to bed.
It's logical to assume that she wasn't wearing them when she was in bed, tossing and turning, trying to fall asleep.
How do you know?
I don't know. I'm guessing. I'm also guessing that she probably didn't put her glasses on when she turned to look casually out of the window. And she herself testified the killing took place just as she looked out. The lights went off a split second later. She couldn't have had time to put them on there.
Wait a second.
Here's another guess. Maybe she honestly thought she saw the boy kill his father. I say she only saw a blur.
How do you know what she saw? How does he know all that? How do you know what kind of glasses she wore? Maybe there were sunglasses. Maybe she was farsighted. What do you know about it?
I only know the woman's eyesight is in question now.
She had to be able to identify a person 60 feet away at night without glasses.
You can't send someone off to die on evidence like that.
Oh, don't give me that.
Don't you think the woman might have made a mistake?
No.
It's not possible.
No, it's not possible.
It's a heck of a cast. In addition to Fonda and Lee J. Cobb, you have Jack Warden, Jack Klugman, E.G. Marshall, Ed Begley. You directed them your first time out on film, and you've since directed Paul Newman and younger actors like Al Pacino and Treat Williams. Is there a difference in the acting styles of the actors who you were directing in the 50s and the actors who came of age in, say, the 70s?
Not really, Terry. The basic craft of acting is, in the United States, has been set for some years, really, even before the method came in. Basically, people like Fonda worked out of a profound sense of truth. In fact, a man like Fonda didn't know how to do anything falsely and used himself brilliantly. Both of those elements are foundations of the method, and even though he wasn't called a method actor in the sense of having studied the method, he basically worked out of that, as most good actors did.
Do you think of yourself as a method director?
No, I become the kind of director that becomes whatever his actors need. When I did Murder on the Orient Express, I could work the way the English actors work. When we did Long Day's Journey Into Night, there was a perfect example. Kate Hepburn has a very specific way of working, her own technique. Ralph Richardson is a prime example of British technique, which is primarily from what we call the outside in. Dean Stockwell works completely method from the inside out, and Jason has his own glorious world of creating something from inside himself, and heaven knows where it comes from. But I think part of the job of directing is to not make the actors work your way, but for you to work as a director any way that makes them comfortable.
You directed Al Pacino in two of his first big movie roles, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. I want to play a short scene from Dog Day Afternoon, and maybe you could tell me what you think Al Pacino needed when he was getting started. This is a scene from the very opening of the movie when Pacino walks into a New York bank and he holds it up and he wants the money to buy a sex change operation for his lover.
Hey, freeze! Nobody move!
Get over there!
Okay. All right, get away from those alarms.
Cut!
Come on, get in the center. He moves. Take his head off. Put the gun on him. Get out of the center.
Sonny? I can't do it, Sonny.
What?
I'm not going to make it, Sonny.
What are you talking about? Put it on.
I can't do it, Sonny.
Sal. What? Where are you? He can't make it.
It's an interesting performance because Pacino is so manic in it and yet so insecure and incompetent at robbing this bank.
Mm-hmm.
What did he need when he was getting started? You were talking before about giving actors what you think they need.
Primarily what he needed was he needed a great sense of freedom and a great sense of restriction. The creation of the character is really Al's own. He understood something about that man that is irreplaceable, and I don't think a director can ever give. He understood him down to his bone marrow. What he needed was a sense of release, the confidence to know that as extreme as he got in the performance, that it would write, that it went... for example, there's a scene toward the end of the movie where he's talking to his female wife, his real wife, on the telephone, trying to decide what to do. And the scene is extraordinary in the sense that it requires a level of emotion that I've seen very rarely in movies. We did the scene in one take with two cameras because I didn't want him to have to repeat that emotion over and over again. And when he finished it the first time, it was wonderful. And without waiting an instant, I didn't even cut the cameras. I said, Al, go again. And he looked at me like I was crazy because he was exhausted. He was spent. And I said, right now, action. And what I was driving at was that he had reached such a height at the end of the first take, such an emotional peak. But that's really where I wanted the scene to begin.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the best pieces of movie acting I've ever seen. It was blinding in its intensity, agonizingly painful, and just reached a level of emotion that I don't think I've seen often in movie acting. And that knowledge that he could go as far as he wanted to within the confines of this situation and that man, the situation created by the script, the man created by Pacino, but that confidence to know that he could go as far as his feelings would carry him was very important to him, and that was really the biggest single directing relationship to his performance.
We're listening back to an interview with Sidney Lumet. He died Saturday at the age of 86. Here's the scene from Dog Day Afternoon that Lumet was just talking about. Al Pacino's character, Sonny, is doing his best to keep it together. The bank robbery is falling apart. He has a bank full of hostages, and he's dealing with the police and the hostage negotiator. In the midst of the chaos, he calls his wife.
I'm dying, you know that? I'm dying here.
Sonny, I blame myself. I notice you've been tense like something is happening. Like night before last, you're yelling at the kids like a madman. And then you want me to go on that ride, that caterpillar, from here to there full of those kids. It's ridiculous. I'm not about to go on the ride, so you yell at me. You pig, get on the ride. Well, everything fell out of me. My heart, my liver just fell to the floor. I mean, everything. You know what it felt like? You yelling at me like that in front of all them people? I mean, because he never talked to me like that before, Sonny. I think he's going to shoot me. He's going to dump my body in the river.
Will you just shut up?
I mean, I was scared of you. I was scared.
Will you shut the f*** and listen to me? Just listen to me!
You see that? See? With the language and everything.
Well, I'm trying to talk to you! And you...
A person can't communicate with you!
A scene from the 1975 film Dog Day Afternoon, directed by Sidney Lumet. Lumet typically shot only one or two takes of each scene.
I wonder if you ever run into conflicts where there's one actor in a scene who works really well on that first or second take, and another actor who sees it as their style to go for 15 or 16 takes until they really get it perfect. What do you do if you run into that?
I have run into it, and so far, if there were a piece of wood around the studio, I'd knock on it. But so far, I've been able to convince the 15 or 16 take actor that the other works. The early takes are not imperfect. They are usually the freshest, truest. The repetition I find, and I think for most good actors, the repetitions tend to become mechanical. One doesn't find more truth in it as it goes on. Now, that partially has to do with the way I work because, as you know, or may know, I rehearse very heavily. I rehearse 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the complexity of the characters, before we begin. And those rehearsals are conducted like theater rehearsals in the sense that people learn their lines completely, are working without scripts, they're completely blocked to the degree that we're having run-throughs by the end of it. So it's not as if once we get on camera that this is their first exposure.
Is that uncommon?
Yes, it is. It is. It is not done often. I think mostly those of us who were trained in television do it. I think Arthur Penn does it. I know Arthur Penn does it. John Frankenheimer and so on.
Oh, because you had to do it for the live drama.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And but it turned out for all of us, I think, in movies to have other advantages.
You know, between 12 Angry Men, The Verdict, Serpico, and Prince of the City, you've done your share of police and legal dramas. Is this a special interest of yours, or did you just like those scripts and want to do them?
It's funny, Terry. You know, I don't really analyze these things. Mm-hmm. I just respond instinctively to a piece of material. But obviously something in me somewhere is very involved with that level of life. Where it comes from, I don't know. But on looking back on it, boy, there are an awful lot of what I call justice stories. They somehow involve me very viscerally.
Have you been affected by the new craze of market research?
Yes, and fortunately, I've had my artistic controls in place before they ever came along because I think they are disastrous. I think they're destructive. I also think they're untrue. I think a person changes as soon as you ask them something.
So do you have a no market research clause when you take on...
No, because I can't prevent the studio from doing it, but mm-hmm. I sure in hell don't let it affect any of my decisions about what I'm going to do with the picture.
You obviously love film directing. When you're doing a movie, what's the part that you most look forward to and the part that you know you have to do but you really don't enjoy at all?
There's only one part that I have to do. All of it is a thrilling process to me, pre-production, shooting, post-production, editing, music. The only part that's a bit of a drag is what we call the mix, which is when we come in and do the final soundtrack and put every chair squeak in and every door slam in. It requires enormous concentration because it's largely a mechanical process rather than a creative one, although some directors use it very creatively. The soundtrack that I keep remembering particularly is the soundtrack of Apocalypse Now, which was a brilliant piece of work and a totally creative piece of work. However, you do have to do it. I feel I have to do it myself because if the mix is a bad mix, if the wrong thing is emphasized, it can seriously affect the movie and be very destructive to a movie. So I have to do it, but it's the only non-joyful part of movie making to me.
Let's hear a scene from Lumet's 1981 film, Prince of the City, adapted from a memoir by a New York City narcotics detective officer who exposed corruption in the unit. Jerry Orbach played one of the dirty narcotics detectives. In this scene, he storms into the office of one of the people in charge of the corruption investigation.
You indict me on a squawk of a dope dealer who tried to buy me out of a bust? You want to break up another federal operation that'll put away more quality mob guys in a year than you'll touch in your whole pissant career?
Detective Levy, you're hardly in a position...
I'll tell you what I'm in a position to do, and that's throw you out the window. It's only the fifth floor, but I'll try to aim you so you land on your pointed little head.
Levy, you can easily avoid trial. All you have to do is cooperate.
You got your mind made up to try me? Go ahead and try me. But not for a lousy $400. At least get me for assault.
Let's get back to our 1988 interview with director Sidney Lumet.
I want to play another short scene from another movie you directed, and this is Network, which came out in 1976. Peter Finch won a posthumous Academy Award for his performance in this. And in this scene, he plays a lunatic, self-styled, messianic broadcaster who is basically preaching his editorial.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crying in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, damn it! My life has value! So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And right after, as he's doing that editorial, people all over Manhattan in high-rise apartment buildings open up their windows, stick their heads out, and start yelling that they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. I thought that scene really tapped into something, and for me what it tapped into is the fear is that in Manhattan there's so many high-rises filled with so many people with all this pent-up anger, and if it was ever let loose, we'd really be in big trouble.
Well, Paddy Chayefsky had that unique ability to tap the most fundamental truths in people. In the individual characters, and also in terms of the situation that he was observing. Did you ever see a picture that he wrote called Hospital?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's hilarious as Network is with fundamentally a deeply serious idea behind it, and he did it in that too. I miss him every day.
Network was one of your many movies that was shot in New York locations. Now, I think you were really one of the first directors to actually do location shooting in Manhattan.
Yeah, Kazan first and me right behind him. But at that time, it wasn't fashionable at all. It was very difficult to put together more than one good movie crew because there was that little work going on here.
Why did you want to shoot on location in New York?
Well, once you were shooting in New York, there was almost no choice. We had very limited studio space in those days, so that you had no choice. But also, it coincided clearly with the kind of picture we were doing, which were usually very realistic pictures, pictures that benefited visually from being done on location.
Were there problems when you were one of the pioneers doing that, since crews weren't used to it? The people on the streets weren't used to having movies shot outside their homes or their offices.
Yeah, but they were all good problems. The problems are much more severe now because everybody's so sophisticated. So they not only charge you a hell of a lot more to use their facility, but they're also a little bit more contemptuous and irritated by the inconvenience that shooting makes. In those days, it was glamorous. People were amazed by it, were diverted by it, enchanted by it. So that the problems in those days were actually less severe than the problems now.
Now, you really came from a theater family. Your father acted in the Yiddish theater. You acted when you were very young. I think you either performed in or a standby in the Dead End Kids on Broadway?
I wasn't one of the Dead End Kids. I was in the play. There were other children's parts.
It was a play called Dead End on
Broadway.
Okay. Right. Now, did this experience with the Yiddish theater via your father and your own performances help you understand actors as a director?
I think so, Terry. The biggest thing about actors is that they really are the infantry. They are the most exposed. And most good work, not just acting, but really any creative work, is a matter of use of self, self-exposure. And as I say, actors are the infantry in that. It's their emotions, their physiognomy that's being examined, rejected, accepted at the actual moment that they're doing it. They're right up there.
Why did you give up acting for directing?
I found that process very invading. When I got out of the Army, I'd been acting since I was 5 years old, and I got out of the Army in 25, and at 25, and went on with it for about another 3 years, and I was primarily a theater actor. I knew that good acting, as I say, is self-exposure to a large degree, and I got sort of embarrassed about revealing those parts of myself to 1,500 strangers a night, if you were in a hit, that is. Otherwise, it was to 50 strangers a night. But there was something about acting that no longer worked for me, and I just slowly drifted into directing.
Did having a father in the Yiddish theater help you love performance?
Absolutely,
drama?
Absolutely. The peculiar thing is there's a sort of strange post-World War II American problem. Children of actors and writers and directors tend to be nervous and upset. And more than nervous, they're terrified of going into their parents' work. And yet the history of the world is going into your parents' work. I mean, 2 years ago, I did a movie with Jane Fonda and Jeff Bridges, and I had worked with both of their fathers. I'd worked with Henry and I'd worked with Lloyd.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that very moving. I was thrilled at working with the two of them because that sense of continuity is lovely. It's the way it should be. And I'm quite sure that my father, being the actor he was and bringing me into the theater at a very early age, was an enormously beneficial and happy-making thing to happen to one.
My interview with film director Sidney Lumet was recorded in 1988. He died Saturday at the age of 86. Will Ferrell guest starred on the NBC series The Office last night in his first of 4 episodes this season, playing the temporary replacement for Steve Carell's character Michael Scott, the manager of the Scranton branch of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company. Steve Carell only has 2 more episodes left before he leaves the show, and fans of the show are wondering who his final replacement will be. We're going to listen back to an interview with Will Ferrell. Let's start with a scene from last night's episode of The Office. Ferrell is trying to assert his own management style, starting by giving some tips to the receptionist. Then Steve Carell walks in, trying to maintain control.
Dunder Mifflin, this is Erin. Okay, let me transfer you.
Why do you use your name when you answer the phone?
Oh, that's how Pam does it. I just copy her. She's sort of a living legend.
Try it without using your name.
Dunder Mifflin. This is. Oh, yeah, I like it.
Dunder Mifflin, how may I assist you?
Oh, assist.
I sort of like the old way. I just prefer it without the name, and I thought,
okay.
No. I got to start doing some managing at some
point,
right?
I know, I'm sorry. But if it's not a big deal, we should just do the old way.
And it really isn't.
Okay. But good?
Yeah, okay.
All
good.
Right.
Well, I'd like to change it, actually.
Well, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you think would work.
What do you
Yeah. I think a change would be nice.
You could do the old way or the, you know, whichever one you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Change it.
I'm so sorry. Sorry.
When I spoke with Will Ferrell in 2006, he told me about an office job he had early on.
You know, I had a period of time kind of post-college when I moved back home for 3 years, a long 3 years, and I worked as a bank teller.
No, really?
Yeah, and I was just starting to explore, you know, taking theater classes and stand-up and those sorts of things. But for the most part, I was kind of back at home, driving from point A to point B and counting money and I didn't have much of a social life, and because a lot of my friends had gone on to real jobs and things like that.
Did you do shtick when you were a bank teller? Did you like impersonate your version of what a bank teller would be?
No, in fact, I was so I found the job so nerve-wracking that I got so quiet because I had to focus with every aspect. I would make one transaction and then shut my window down for 15 minutes to make sure everything was still there. And one day it slipped out that I did stand-up comedy, and one of the managers came up to me and just stared at me and was like, "You're funny? I don't believe it." And I said, "Well, yeah, I can be." But I I go, "You'll have to come see a show." And so it was kind of my alter ego that outside of work I had this place to kind of, you know, go crazy up on stage.
So when you went to, like, audition for Saturday Night Live, the story goes that you took a trunk of, like, a suitcase of Monopoly money with you so that you could do what?
Well, I had read somewhere that Adam Sandler had gone and had a meeting with Lorne Michaels and had gone into this meeting kind of sight unseen and had done this really funny bit and where he, I don't know, mimicked having sex with a chair or something and was hired on the spot. And I thought, well, I'm gonna follow that, like, be funny in the room and kind of take advantage, you know, of the moment, to kind of seize the day type of attitude. So I thought what would be really funny is if I walk in with a briefcase full of toy money and just start piling it on his desk and say, "Lauren, look, we can talk, you know, till the cows come home, but we really know what talks, and that's money. And I'm going to walk out of this room, and you can either take this money or leave it on your desk. I'll never know the difference." And hopefully he'd think it's funny that I stacked all this fake counterfeit money. But when I got in, the atmosphere was so intense that I never got to my big joke, and I just sat there with my briefcase in my lap. Which, when I left, it felt insane because I remember I was thinking, well, he must be thinking, what comedian walks in with a briefcase and just sits there nervously? And so I never, and then we had another meeting where I tried to do it again, and the assistant said, "Oh, leave your briefcase. You don't need that." And then that was, lo and behold, that was the meeting where he told me I had the job. And then as I left, I gave a handful of the fake money to the assistant. I was like, "Can you please give this to him? It's kind of symbolic." And I tried to do this twice, but I could never do it. So can you give him this fake money? And in hindsight, he thought it was really funny that I'd tried twice to do this gag, and it never kind of came to fruition.
One of the impressions that you did on Saturday Night Live, one of the characters you did was James Lipton from the Actors Studio broadcast.
Yes.
That was always so much fun.
It was kind of amazing how much James Lipton loved the impression, so much so that he had me come on his 100th episode as him. And we did an interview back and forth where we he asked me questions, which was very surreal as he stood over my shoulder watching me get into makeup saying, "Yes, the transformation has begun. I'm watching you becoming me." And it was very – and he watched the whole 30 minutes it takes me to get in that makeup. And I was like, you can go get a sandwich if you want at some point, you know. And he was like, "No, this is fascinating." But one of the many interesting things that has happened to me.
Did you notice things sitting across the table from him that you hadn't noticed watching on TV?
Not really. I don't know. I think if anything I noticed was I felt like, God, I think I slightly underplay him. I could go even bigger.
Let's actually hear you doing James Lipton on Saturday Night Live. So this is Will Ferrell.
On the 13th of January, 1931, right here in New York City, magic happened. An artist was born that would rival Leonardo da Vinci or Michelangelo. But his tools would not be pen, nor brush, nor chisel, nor palette. His tools would be his comically oversized glasses and his soul. So please, welcome the greatest performer ever to have graced this earth, Charles Nelson Reilly.
That's Will That's Ferrell so doing James Lipton. And later in the sketch, Charles Nelson Reilly is played by Alec Baldwin. So how do you study somebody like Lipton when you're doing an impersonation of him? Like, what is your process of watching somebody, whether it's Lipton or President Bush?
I usually have to just pick one key thing and then emphasize that again and again and again, and then hope that the rest kind of fills in. But with with Bush, I as I tried to work on him vocally, I really just worked on it more from the way he kind of scrunched up his face and kind of squinted his eyes and almost started from that approach. And with Lipton, I just tried to over enunciate. And so I usually try to key on one thing where, you know, when you speak to someone like Daryl Hammond, who's still on Saturday Night Live, he is such a kind of a scientist about it. He can tell you that a person has had, you know, dental work because of the way they pop their T's and this and that. He can listen to every single thing. And I'm not able to do that. So I would just kind of find one key thing to hone in on.
Do you ever have anxiety dreams about your work?
Oh, yeah. I think anyone who has, you know, is in any sort of artistic pursuit kind of goes up and down with the way they feel about their work. And I for the most part, am a pretty happy person. But, I go through definite periods of time where I'm not funny, I'm not good, I don't feel original. I'm always joking with my wife that, when I get kicked out of show business, I'm always trying to think of alternate careers. And so far, I've
bank
come
teller.
Up with cab driver. I can go back to bank teller. Maybe UPS, too. UPS is high on the list. But, yeah, you definitely have anxiety.
Can you share an anxiety dream, like the kind of dream that you have about comedy and something going terribly wrong?
Well, I'll still have, like, Saturday Night Live stress dreams where mm-hmm. the show has started and I'm making a quick change backstage and the microphone in my dressing room wasn't on, so I didn't hear that the show started, or the speaker, I mean, and I have to run out in the middle of a sketch and figure out where I am and things like that.
What's the worst thing that actually did happen to you live on the air on Saturday Night Live?
You know what? I was doing an update feature where on Weekend Update on the fake news section, you know, the characters will sometimes come out. And I was, my glasses started fogging up to where I couldn't read the cue cards. And then I started laughing. And it was this kind of this wonderful kind of crazy situation of I was having this laughing attack and I can't see anything. And I literally kind of had to just stop and wipe off my glasses and then get back to reading the cue cards. So it was actually kind of really fun, free fall of like, oh, well, there's no way to rescue this. But the audience kind of loves it in a way when they're watching that happen.
So did you stay in character while you were wiping off your
glasses?
Yeah,
I did. It was I did this character who suffered from voice immodulation. Which was someone who I only could speak like this. I had no control of the volume of my voice. So whether I was speaking intimately or shouting, it was the same voice level. So I would have asides to myself. Like, boy, I don't think, you know, she doesn't smell very good. You know, so it would be... So I could never have a private moment and that I was afflicted with this disease and people didn't think it was a real disease and I was the champion of this thing. It was very, it's bizarre.
Well, Will Ferrell, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too, Terry. Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Will Ferrell recorded in 2006. He guest stars in the next three episodes of The Office. His new movie, Everything Must Go, will be shown at the Tribeca Film Festival next week. It opens in theaters in May. Many of us know little about the aftermath of the Lincoln assassination beyond the killing of John Wilkes Booth in a barn. Robert Redford's new film, The Conspirator, focuses on the months of post-assassination arrests and trials, particularly on Mary Surratt, the woman alleged to have aided the plotters. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The Conspirator centers on the real-life trial of Mary Surratt. She ran a Washington boarding house that was regularly visited by men involved in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, among them Surratt's son and the assassin himself, John Wilkes Booth. The government charges Mary, played by Robin Wright, with being a participant in the plot, which is a crime punishable by death. But there will, at this time of heightened emotions, with so many people rounded up, be no jury of her peers. A military tribunal will hear her case, and normal rules of evidence won't apply. It falls to Surratt's lawyer, Frederick Aiken, played by James McAvoy, to argue not merely for his client, but also a principle, that the U.S. Constitution must apply to everyone, guilty or innocent, in times of peace or peril. It would be easy to call The Conspirator a dramatized civil liberties lecture. Director Robert Redford is not a man who keeps his political convictions to himself, and his agenda could hardly be plainer. Because Redford makes the defendant's legal case, it's important to say he does nothing to make them admirable. They're fools and monsters. The Conspirator opens with Lincoln's assassination and the mayhem that follows. On his makeshift deathbed across from Ford's Theater, the president is barely glimpsed, only his shoes and the bowls of blood carried from the room. We want vengeance for this crime as much as the mobs on screen. Wright's Mary isn't likable either, at least at first. She admits to being a Confederate sympathizer, but is otherwise so starkly private, so withholding, that we can't blame Aiken for hating her. He fought for the Union and didn't want her case, which has made him a social pariah. He wants to know about the son she's protecting, who's still on the lam.
My son was in Canada that day.
Can you prove that?
I received a letter on April 14th. Same day as the assassination. Sent from Montreal.
Where is this letter?
I don't know.
I'm done. Done defending your lies.
You're so blind with hatred, Mr. Aiken, you can't even see the truth. Yes, my son hated the North, we all did. How can a Southerner feel anything but bitterness towards your side? But my son did not conspire to kill your president. He conspired to kidnap him.
What did Mary know, and when did she know it? It's hard to say. Wright makes her vividly uncommunicative, torn in too many directions to make anything but her essential decency plain. Evan Rachel Wood plays her daughter, Anna, who hasn't been allowed to see or speak to Mary, and you believe they're related. They have the same mixture of fear and anger, the same tightness. Because both actresses give such tough, unsentimental performances, the moment when Anna testifies in court and soldiers line up to block Mary from her view is so cruel, it's devastating. Where Redford and screenwriter James Solomon fail is in making a compelling case for the other side, the one that says the survival of the nation takes precedence over individual rights. The spokesman for that view, who's transparently eager to orchestrate Mary's hanging, is the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, played by Kevin Kline.
It's not justice you're after, it's revenge.
I would never go to such lengths out of vengeance. But to ensure the survival of this nation, I would do anything. Mary Surratt was a party to the most grievous crime in our history. Necessity demands that she be given a swift, sure, and harsh sentence. I, too, hold sacred our rights, Counselor. But they count not at all. If our nation ceases to exist,
McAvoy carries that scene. He gives real dramatic urgency to what might have played like lecture notes. But Kline is as bad as his material, as only a liberal playing a reactionary can be. This conflict between civil liberties and national security is endlessly current, and in 1865, with the nation barely recovered from being torn asunder, the national security side deserves a spokesman of stature. It doesn't get it. The Conspirator is a graceful film with a heartbreaking climax, but instead of a great and timeless drama, it's just a powerful melodrama.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed The Conspirator. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Roberta Schurek directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.